This is fresh air. John Lurie's movies and music have given him the image of the ultimate downtown New York bohemian. He starred in the downbeat films Stranger Than Paradise and Down by Law. Lurie also scored both films. For the past 10 years, he's performed and recorded with his band, the Lounge Lizards. Their brand of jazz was bathed in irony, but a lot of the irony is gone in their new record, Voice of Chunk. This is the opening track, Bob the Bob, composed by Lurie. He's featured on alto saxophone. His brother Evan Lurie is on piano. Compositions on your new record, like Bob the Bob, sound very influenced by world music. Have you been traveling?
Yeah, actually, it was strange. I did this little thing in Last Temptation of Christ, and
you were an apostle, right?
Yeah, I was Saint James. I'm basically the beard behind Willem Dafoe, is my part. I met these guys called Ganawa musicians who I'd heard about before and started playing with them. But Bob the Bob I had actually written about 2 months before that. So when I started playing with these Ganawa musicians, I found things in my own playing rather than that I was copying them. So it was kind of more, what's the word, organic for me or something.
So this was in Morocco while you were shooting The Last Temptation of Christ?
Yeah.
Did you sit in with them at all?
Yeah. Well, the first thing that happened was I was looking for Ganawa musicians, and I was introduced to a bunch of guys who were not... Ganawa's got a whole spiritual background behind it, and it's not just a musical form. It's a whole lifestyle, which I don't know enough about to tell you. But there was I met some phony Ganawas, so to speak. Then I met a French guy who was a fan of my band who was doing some kind of... his military service in Morocco for some weird reason, and he had... These guys come to my room and we play almost every night. So yeah, I got to play with them a lot.
I was wondering if you felt more comfortable sitting in with them than you have with jazz musicians in America.
You know, I'm not the guy to sit in. I've always shied away from this thing of sitting in. It always seems to be a disaster. Also, the way I play doesn't really, you know, I'm not really good for a cutting contest. I play less and less and less. I'm not really like, you know, my bebop technique is sorely lacking. So I guess I did feel more comfortable with them. I like the reason that they play music more. I like the essence of the music more. That's where my heart is, you know?
How is the reason that they play music different from the reason you think jazz musicians play music?
Well, I think I can't say why jazz musicians actually play music. For me, with jazz, I'm only really interested in the big voices and the people like Coltrane or Monk or Dolphy. But then all these hundreds of people who sound like someone else or a synthesis of three or four styles, I have no interest in this. And I don't know why they play, actually.
The sound on your new record is in some ways a different tone than the ironic, moody, film noirish kind of music you've made a lot of in the past.
Yeah,
is this like a new direction you're heading in?
I think it's more real somehow. I think I the film noir stuff was a little bit of a pose, I'm afraid to say, or something, or just, you know, you try and find your voice. You know, you spend a long time trying to find your voice in whatever you do, if whatever art form, or I suppose no matter what it is, you find it. And so I feel like I finally found it. I mean, I'm very proud of the last album, where I never really had that feeling before where I would come out of the studio and say, oh, I'm really proud of what this was. And this one, I'm really proud. And that's why I'm doing the business thing like this, you know?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's ironic in a way that the place where you feel you lost the pose was going to another country and getting a sense of the music there.
Yeah, see, I find in America people tend to play music as a career. And I don't think of music like that. And I think that that's very scary if you think about music is supposed to be something more than that. It's supposed to be something involved with magic and something involved with religion in some kind of way. And I think that that's really important. And in America, we seem to have lost that thread.
There is one noirish type track on your new record. I'm thinking of The Hanging.
The Hanging. I almost didn't put The Hanging on there because I felt like it didn't quite go with the rest of the material. But you know, when you're sequencing something, I found a spot that it would fit, you know?
Tell me about writing it, when you wrote it, what you had in mind.
The Hanging in particular?
Yeah.
The Hanging was one of those ones where I was sitting on my bed watching TV, and I had the saxophone out, you know, and I was just sort of playing, and somebody said, oh, that was really nice. And I said, really? And so then I made something into it. It was no big deal. It's a little Mingus-y, and I like this thing where I always like that thing where you've got a flatted third and then you have a raised seventh. I know that that's not going to help you, but this sort of Harlem Nocturne-y kind of sound.
The term fake jazz to describe what you started doing early on in your career. What did you mean by that?
Oh, I don't know. It was a really unfortunate thing I did. It was, you know, we had just thrown the Lounge Lizards together on the first occasion that we played. My brother had just moved to New York, and somebody had asked me what was a good band to open for somebody and said, oh, my band, not having a band. We threw this thing together, 6 hours of rehearsal, and we played. And for some reason, I had been known a little bit for, I had directed these Super 8 movies, and Ardo Lindsay was in the band, and he had DNA, and Anton Fear was in the band, and he was in the Philly, so we were sort of well known, but it was a joke the first night, and we finished, and suddenly it was this immense success. People went absolutely crazy, and there was all these people rushing into the dressing room after the show. I said, what do you call this music? And I said, oh, it's fake jazz, and it stuck, which, you know, if I had known it was going to stick, I would have given a little more thought to it. But
what were the bad repercussions of having it stick?
Well, see, I'm a little bit, you know, it's particularly, this is 1979 we're talking about, and the what was happening in the jazz world was just the most, people who were, either it was really incredibly indulgent stuff where people thought that they were playing like Coltrane, but they were just really doing this sort of masturbatory jazz, or else they were playing music that you could you know, eat steak and drink wine too. And neither one was particularly interesting to me. And so I was, because basically my influence was jazz, but I didn't want to be involved in the jazz world. It seemed like a really sure death, not just financially, but also it was like jazz was a dirty word by at this point in time.
Your early days at the Lounge Lizards coincided with the punk rock. And I was wondering if that was that was good timing for you, because you played a lot of the rock clubs, and like technique wasn't really highly prized in punk. I mean, it wasn't about technique; it was about the sound and about the energy, and attitude in a way.
Yeah, but in a way, it was bad because I'm very serious about music, you know, and I do have a certain reverence to jazz. And so that it came along in punk times. What basically happened is that I had a career before while I should have been woodshedding. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so that I was suddenly in the public, but I couldn't really play that well. And so it helped and it hurt.
Do you feel like your music changed as you started getting more at home with the instrument and more?
No, I got more at home. I got more at home running the band and making the band work. Mm-hmm. I think that was more the thing.
Is it true that you had your two front teeth knocked out?
The left one, yeah.
Oh, the left one?
Yeah.
By a bouncer?
But he wasn't a legitimate bouncer. I don't know what the deal was. It was very shady people. Suddenly this club had a whole new set of bouncers working there, and God knows who they were. But they decided to beat me up.
Were you playing there or training?
No, I was hanging out there. It was late. I was there, and it's a silly story. They had these two bathrooms upstairs, which were never delegated to which one was a men's room and which one was a woman's room. And so my girlfriend actually had to go to the bathroom, which was a rare occasion for using the bathrooms in one of these clubs. And I was holding the door while she went to the bathroom because there was no locker. And so there's a bang on the door, and I say, just a minute. And they say, no men in the women's room, which was quite a shock to me because nobody had ever had any idea that this was actually the women's room. And I said, I'm just holding the door. You'll have to wait. And when I opened the door, there were four guys standing there, and they were all 5'10", and they all weighed 250 pounds, and they all had the same mustaches, same haircuts, and same jackets. And I said, look at that. They all look alike. And so one of them punched me. And then one of them kicked me, and then I got up like I was going to do something about it. I can't believe that. And then one of them held me, and the other one punched me in the face and knocked my tooth out.
So do you have a fake tooth now?
Yeah, but a very nice one. It's actually whiter than the rest of the teeth.
Did it change your embouchure?
Yeah, it screwed me up because I had to actually have 8 different front teeth before I could get it back. It did change my playing. It was very hard to get used to a new front tooth because, you know, the way the mouthpiece rests on your teeth, it has to be really, your teeth get worn down to the shape of the mouthpiece, and so switching was incredibly difficult.
Do you want to do more acting, and do you want to do more than the kind of roles that you've done? In other words, not have a certain type of character that you always play?
Yeah, I certainly would like to do something other than those kind of offbeat beatniks that I've played. But acting is not, you know, I feel a little bit like a jerk saying, yeah, I want to act. I mean, I don't really have, I haven't sort of paid my dues, you know, uh-huh. as an actor. And I really go, though I definitely am acting, I go by such a natural thing. I just, if I could do it more, I think I could be great. But I don't do it enough, and I don't really have the time to pursue it.
Your music is really considered a part of the New York downtown scene. Where are you from?
I was born in Minneapolis. Then I moved to New Orleans when I was 6. And then I moved to Worcester, Massachusetts when I was around 10. I've been in New York forever, as far as 74 or something like that.
Now, your father had been a museum curator and college professor when you were in Minnesota, is that right?
Uh-huh.
And he was blacklisted? What for?
For being in the Communist Party. But that's not all exactly true. He wasn't really blacklisted. He just had to move around very quickly because he was in trouble. But he didn't actually get blacklisted.
And what did he do after the blacklist?
He had this idea. He did a lot of different stuff. He finally ended up doing selling Israeli bonds, of all things. Yeah, I don't know. See, my dad was this very, very secretive man, and so when he died, I didn't know that much about him, and so now I'm just sort of piecing together things about him and can't really, I don't really know what the whole deal was with my dad.
Were your parents, like, more politically motivated and goal-oriented than you were when you were young?
It's hard to say. My father was this very strange man, and when he died, I felt like that he had been a failure because he had never accomplished anything truly artistic. And apparently, he had gone, you know, to Columbia and NYU and written they expected him to be the next James Joyce or something, as far as I can understand. And then he went to the South and organized farm workers and never actually wrote a book or anything. Now, I felt like my father was a bit of a failure when he died. Went to a wedding about 3 years after he died, and all these 60 and 70-year-old men were coming over to me and saying, your father was a real hero of mine, which kind of blew me away. But I think it instilled in me some kind of need. For example, why I'm doing the record, why I'm doing this 1-800-44-CHUNK business, is because I feel like you can't just do the work and then let it sit there and nobody knows it. You have to get it out there. And it's sort of, it instilled some kind of drive in me to make things recognized or something.
Mm-hmm. You're selling the record through an 800 number, though I think the record's in stores now too, isn't it?
It's in some stores, yeah. But mm-hmm. you can receive the record by calling 1-800-44-CHUNK. What? Which is also the name of the record company.
What did you decide to handle it yourself?
That's a hard question. I thought it would be fun. I was just really sick of very bad distribution that I'd had before with other labels. And I paid for this record myself, and paid for the record myself because the band was just really ripe to record these things. And mm-hmm. I knew if I started to, you know, I didn't have a label at the time, I knew that it would take, you know, it takes, between the lawyers and all this stuff, it takes 3, 4, 5 months to get it ready to go, you know? And so I just decided, I'll do it now. It's time, you know? And so I did it, and I thought, this is a great album. It's going to be a breeze to sell this, you know? And, of course, in Japan and in Germany and around the world, I had people bidding on it, you know, 4, 5, 6 companies in each country. And in United States, they wouldn't return my calls, you know, or Valerie Goodman's calls, who was doing the business. I just was kind of shocked by this, because I had people really chasing me for this record. In America, so I said, well, I'm not going to grovel. I've been around too long. There's really no reason for them to not. There's some kind of problem. I'm not going to take this personally. It's some kind of real problem with the system of how music is being distributed in this country. And so I'm going to just do it myself. I'll kick these guys in the pants a little bit.
Well, John Lurie, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Okay.
Actor, musician, and composer John Lurie. The new Lounge Lizards record is called Voice of Chunk. This is Fresh Air.